Public Safety Committee will come to order. Members, we have two agenda items today and an informational hearing this afternoon. With that, Representative Savick moves the minutes of March 26, 2014. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. The first bill on the agenda is Representative Allen. Is she here?
Mr. Chair, I certainly could start presenting it for you if you'd like.
Well, we can. Representative Moran is here. Let's do 2373 then, and when Representative Allen comes, we will do the forfeiture bill. So, Representative Moran, are you ready? And do you have your testifiers here? Oh, she is here? Wait a sec. Where is she? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Representative Moran, we'll take your bill in a minute. I didn't see Representative Allen. So, Representative Allen, if you'd like to come up, welcome to the committee. Representative Hillstrom, would you like to move House File 1082?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Does it go to the General Register?
It does, indeed.
I will move House File 1082 be re-referred to the General Register.
Okay. Representative Allen, welcome to the committee. You want to explain the bill and tell us what it does and introduce your testifiers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, to start with what this bill does, give you a little background, and also tell you what this bill does not do. So House File 1082 requires an admission of guilt, a conviction, diversion, or stay of adjudication for a drug-related crime in criminal court as a prerequisite to losing property through forfeiture in civil court. And I believe we can all agree that no one acquitted of a crime should lose his or her property through civil forfeiture. In forfeiture cases in civil court, current state law requires a conviction in criminal court for some crimes, including prostitution, fleeing a police officer, DWI, and certain other designated offenses. In other words, to show that the crime occurred for the purposes of forfeiture in civil court, state law requires the conviction from the criminal trial be introduced into evidence in the civil case. This, I think we can all agree, is good policy. And what we're talking about here is an exception. In forfeitures involving an underlying drug crime, however, the burden of proof is different. In those forfeiture cases, the burden is on the property owner to prove in civil court the seized property, usually cash or vehicles, is not associated with the controlled substance. Nothing that happens in criminal court matters. And this is the exception where this bill ends that exception. It makes a conviction or its equivalent in criminal court a prerequisite for all civil forfeitures. And as I previously mentioned, in addition to convictions, House File 1082 allows for other equivalent showing of guilt in drug-related cases, including the property owner suspect agreeing to a diversion or having the judge stay his criminal sentence, or if the informant enters a plea bargain. And this was the agreement we reached with the Minnesota County Attorneys Association there's four things that this bill does not do. It does not change the two-track system of criminal prosecution in criminal court and civil forfeiture in civil court. The bill does not change the administrative process that prosecutors use, which accounts for 97% of forfeitures. This process is used for forfeiture of abandoned property. This bill changes none of the work by police officers and sheriffs. This bill changes the work only of prosecutors. And finally, this bill does not change Minnesota's innocent owner laws. And I'll, before I introduce the testifiers, I just want to mention that this is widely supported by, thank the co-authors here. We have 25 total co-authors, and it, as I said, this language has been agreed to by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and this bill is also supported by the Minnesota Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, ACLU, Institute for Justice, and Second Chance Coalition. And then, Mr. Chair, if Mr. McGrath is here to testify.
Very good. Mr. McGrath, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lee McGrath. I'm the Executive Director of the Institute for Justice Minnesota Chapter. As Representative Allen said, no one acquitted of a crime in criminal court should lose their property in through civil forfeiture. But at the same time, no one who is convicted or admits to a crime or takes a stay of adjudication or enrolls in a diversion has a property right that should be recognized by the state. And so what this bill does is recognizes the balance between those who are acquitted and those who are convicted or admit or take a or their conviction has been stayed. I'd be happy to answer any other questions the committee may have about this legislation, but let me just end by thanking the committee and Representative Allen and the chairs of the various committees who have heard this bill, and add that it is a marvelous coalition to work with the ACLU and the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers on this project and others.
Thank you. Representative Allen or Mr. McGrath, just help me out here on Section 1 of the bill, number 2. I'm just not getting that, what that means.
Mr. Chairman, members, this is a provision that on line 115 you're referring to?
Yes.
This is a provision that defines the equivalence to a conviction. And so in addition to a conviction, line 115. This is related to informants. And so if a person agrees with law enforcement that to inform on others who may be charged with a crime, that counts as an equivalent and meets the prerequisite, the conviction prerequisite.
That was about as clear as mud for me, but maybe everybody else gets it.
Let me try again. I apologize, Mr. Chairman. This is a person who has agreed to a plea bargain. That plea bargain requires that person to be an informant, and this bill recognizes, so that happens in the criminal court, this bill recognizes that equivalency in the criminal court, in the civil court, for the purposes of forfeiture.
Mr. Chair.
Can you add to this, Representative Hellstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, so in many instances, you might see someone who's going to be charged with a drug offense, and maybe it's a lower-level drug offense, and they don't want to be charged. And so they say, if you want my supplier, I will take you to my supplier if you don't charge me with that crime or if you agree to dismiss the charges against me. But if there have been proceeds of that original crime, they don't get to benefit from the crime that they committed, just because they choose to turn to assist in collecting other criminals.
That provides clarity. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Schoen.
I was going to try to help, too.
Oh, okay. Got it now.
Mr. Chairman, I'll
Representative, Representative Allen.
These different types of proceedings, too, we don't want to create an incentive to go after the conviction or a disincentive to allow defendants to participate in diversion programs or other types of proceedings. We want to recognize those.
Okay. Questions of Representative Allen or the testifier? Representative Schoen.
Hi. And just to clarify, Mr. Chair and Representative Allen, if they say, and I wish I could remember what the plea would be, but that they don't plead guilty, but they say that there's enough evidence to convict them of the crime, this covers that section as well?
Mr. McGrath?
That would be, Mr. Chairman, Representative Schoen, that would be an admission of guilt, and that would be one of the equivalents that this bill recognizes as meeting the prerequisite and can be introduced into evidence in the civil case involving the cash or the vehicle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If somebody could remind me that my brain is not working real well this morning already, what that term is, Representative Hillstrom.
Representative Hillstrom, do you know the term?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's an Alford plea when the defendant says that based on what's in the police reports and based on the testimony, they believe that the evidence would, there's a reasonable likelihood that they would be convicted at trial of the offense.
Thank you.
I forget that, too. Any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak in favor of the bill? Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Benjamin Feist, and I'm the legislative director for the ACLU of Minnesota. I'm just here today to also express our support of this bill. I don't think I'll be brief because I don't think I have anything to add, except for the fact that this is an issue that the ACLU has been concerned about and working on for many years, and one that our membership has been very interested in. We believe that the bill today is a huge step forward in reforming forfeiture law in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Feist. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak in favor of the bill? Is there anyone who wishes to speak in opposition to the bill? Okay, then. Are there any further questions or comments? Representative Allen, I'll give you the last word if there isn't.
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so the Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 1082 be placed on the General Register. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Members, if I can just... you'll just indulge me for a couple of minutes. This is our last committee meeting, as far as I know. It's sort of like a bill, you know, it's never dead till it's dead. Well, this committee may still meet again, but this is our last scheduled meeting, and we do have this informational hearing on Representative Hillstrom's bills. Are those your bills tonight, this afternoon? But I just wanted to thank some people here for all the hard work. This has been an incredible session given the short period of time that we've had. And I'd like to first, and this is also my final meeting, I'm assuming, as a member of this committee. So I did want to thank a few people, Becky and Jeff. You know, since I've been chair of the committee, I've just, I always wonder what it would be like to be nonpartisan staff and work with this group, but I... Where is Jeff? He's not here yet. But I thank you so much for your work, and to John Waltz, the fiscal analyst, and Gary Carger before you. You two have always known where all the bodies are buried around the huge bureaucracy and have worked here a long time, and I really, I think... Representative Cornish would agree, having people with that kind of financial analysis is so important to our work. John Holquist, always a decent guy, always trust him, GOP research. And my team, my committee administrator, Laura Taken-Holtze, and DJ Danielson, my legislative assistant, I mean, you guys really... helped me out. We were a team. I'm not sure they knew quite what they were getting into last year when we did the gun bill, but they handled it with respect and helped me out enormously. Our pages, Sean, Trevor, Amanda Rudolph, I don't know if she's here, the Sergeant at Arms, to both parties for just being so incredibly respectful and thoughtful. And as we debated the issues in front of this committee, Representative Rosenthal, Vice Chair of the Committee, Representative Cornish, I remember just, if I can just tell this quick little story, I remember last year in the midst of all that gun issue, there were some people who were favoring my bills and some of the gun bills that came forward. And I was meeting with them, and they said they were just tearing Representative Cornish apart, you know. Tony Cornish. And I said, you know, Tony's my friend. And they were going, what? And I said, well, I said, we don't go hunting coyotes with my AR-15s, but I, but he's my friend. Actually, I don't have an AR-15, but, and.
Let's get him.
And, you know, I've been in this, on this committee on and off mostly for 18 years, and Representative Smith and I used to trade places here, and I really miss Representative Smith. He was really a star in the legislature, and it's, and you know, I know people lose elections, but he and I also had a very respectful relationship. And one final person I want to thank here, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but Kate Weeks has been DFL research here since, you know, I've been, I don't know, as long as I can remember. But as chair, I've always, you know, there's a there's so many issues that come before us, and they're difficult issues. And I had always, not always, but from time to time, I'd just say to Kate, I'd say, what's the right thing to do? And she'd tell me, and I'd do it. Because you got to take the politics when it comes to public safety out of our equation. And I always respected her opinion. Thank you, Kate. So, just wanted to say that, and I just finally, I just want to say that, you know, when I started in this committee, I just, I think things have really changed here, and you know, I think we've gotten a lot smarter in fighting crime. I hope we have. You know, when I came here, drug courts, we didn't even, you know, we didn't have drug courts, we didn't have problem-solving courts, we didn't think about reentry programs to try to help offenders who were leaving our prisons to reintegrate back into society. We didn't put much money into treatment or prevention, and you know, we're doing that now, and I hope that that continues. You know, because we have a tough struggle on our hand. This is to ensure that violent offenders are incarcerated as they should be, but also knowing that 95% of them are getting out and they're coming back to our communities. So I feel really good that we've had a collective and respectful voice for justice in the state of Minnesota, and I thank you all.
Mr.
So,
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say that I didn't have a list today to thank, and I don't want to miss anybody, so I'll just say ditto to your comments to the staff and the research and our legals here and everybody involved and the rest of the committee. But yeah, the media and different people and groups have tried to make a fight between you and I over the years here, but they don't realize that we were friends and that I think I've defended you in certain times and you've defended me. And I remember that during the times of the committee hearings in the midst of all this, and you've taken some pretty bad slurs from groups, personal stuff, all the while that they didn't know that we were, you know, working together well and talking about things. So I sure appreciate your good humor and your personality and how you've handled everything here. And so we're going to miss you. And some of the stuff that you have done here, we will carry on. I mean, some of the legacy that you leave about, you know, domestic abuse and the shelters and the other things that you like to put money into, we will carry on. There's some things that might drop, or philosophical differences will be different, but I'm pretty proud of a lot of the stuff you've done, and so we'll miss you.
Thank you.
Amen.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's probably not normal that someone on your own side would say this in committee, but when I first came to the legislature, you sat next to me in the Public Safety Committee, and I clicked my pen, and I turned to my chair, and you turned to me, and you put your hand on my hand and said, can you stop it? But ever since that time, you have been an incredible mentor as a chair, and we haven't always agreed on all issues. But I have to tell you, Representative Paymer, that I believe that you have always done an incredible job of helping the House DFL Caucus and the Republican Caucus navigate through these issues. So thank you for your
thank
service.
Thank you.
I got one more.
Mr. Chair, you know, as a freshman legislator, you come over here and get thrown into the mix and dealing with some of the very, very difficult issues that we dealt with in this committee and things. And I think you've always been very fair and very understanding for all of us. facing so much flack from so many people and everything else, but you always kept your cool, and you've run just a great committee, I think, and it's been a wonderful experience for me.
Thank you very much. Okay, before as long as I can still talk here, I'd like to move on. Representative Moran, House File 2373. The chair will move House File 2073, and is this going to Ways and Means? This is going to Ways and Means. Representative Moran, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair and members. And, you know, what an honor it is to be here on this last day of the committee hearing and to sit before the chair. And as we've all shared, I just want to share that, you know, you have always been an upstanding guy, and I'm going to miss you.
Thank you. Do you want to introduce the bill and tell us what it does and and why it's in front of this committee, and then we can take your testifiers.
Okay. So the purpose of House File 2373 is to begin correcting the gender earning gap in the Minnesota workforce to improve the economic status of women. Minnesota women who are working full-time and year-round still earn only 80% of the earnings for their male counterparts. And the gap is even larger for women of color, rural women, and older women. Furthermore, the gap is not going away on its own. It has been stagnant for the last 10 years. Minnesota has had pay equity laws on the book for 30 years now, and gender pay equity is now a reality for all state employees and for every city, county, and school district in the state. Now it's time to build on that success by extending pay equity, or as we have reframed it, to equal pay, to private businesses that want to contract with the state. This bill builds on both the success with pay equity laws and the state long practice of requiring these same businesses to submit affirmative action plans in order to bid on state contracts. We think this bill offers a first step in the process of ensuring that companies doing business with the state are paying women equally. The bill offers a first step in the process, and it keeps business data private. It applies only to contracts for goods and services over $500,000 and businesses with more than 50 employees in the state of Minnesota. And I will stop there and would like to...
Representative Moran, before you we turn it over to the testifier, do you have two amendments? Do you want both of them offered?
The
E4 and the 840-840-944.
I would like to move the D4, the DE4 only.
The DE4 only. The chair will move the DE4 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. You want to tell us what that amendment did, just so we know what...
The DE4?
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to pass that over to my first testifier.
Okay. Commissioner, welcome to the committee. Sean, are you good? Oh, I see.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. When we're looking at the proposed bill, and there has been one that has made its way through the Senate, when we look at these respective bills, what has changed is moving from 40 to 50 employees. The language as relates to the EEO-1 statement, which is contained, and the thought process is that with the EEO-1 statement at the federal law, that this would comply with subcontractors and their obligations to supply data to federal agencies. So in essence, we would align sort of the requirements from the federal to the state, and there would be no additional burdens borne by subcontractors in providing information to the extent that they're already going to be providing this information to their federal counterparts.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Moran.
Could I make an oral amendment?
Sure.
Okay. In looking at 1.8, subdivision 1, and would like that the pay equity compliance to be changed to equal pay certificate of compliance.
It's already on the heading.
But I want to have the exact language. It now states pay equity compliance, and I think we want to use equal pay compliance.
Are you talking about on line 1.8?
Yes. After subdivision 1, period, it should state equal pay compliance.
Not certificate of compliance?
Not pay equity compliance.
Okay, so equal pay compliance. So the chair will...
Mr. Chair, I heard it two different ways. It should say equal pay certificate of compliance or equal pay compliance?
It should say equal pay certificate of compliance.
Okay, you want it that way. Equal pay certificate. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative, who asked? Representative
Kiefer. Real quick. I'm sorry. I don't think the testifier said his name.
Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, Commissioner.
Representative Kiefer, you're correct. This is Kevin Lindsay, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights.
Okay, let's figure out the exact language. Representative Moran, do you want equal pay certificate of compliance on line 1.8?
Yes. It should state equal pay certificate of compliance.
Okay. So the chair will move that oral amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Commissioner or Representative Moran, you want to just... You can explain a little bit more about the bill, or is that it?
Sure. If I may, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, what this bill would really seek to do is try to get at the issue of two things. One, ensuring compliance among state contractors, and then also gathering information as relates to the practices of state contractors to ensure compliance with the law. Currently, we have, under Minnesota law, a requirement for state contractors to provide information as relates to their hiring practices. That's known as a workforce certificate. For those individual contractors, we start at 40 employees and a contract of 100,000. So there's already an analogous process in place. This would borrow from that particular structure, but we have narrowed the number of contractors that would be obligated to provide information to the department for purposes of obtaining a certificate. So that would be moved from 40 to 50, and then the number or the amount of the contract would move from $100,000 to $500,000. The process set forth with the obtaining of the certificate is set forth on the first page of the respective bill. It is a very streamlined process. The difference here is that a statement would be submitted by the contractor adhering to compliance with the law in identifying the practices that they implement to ensure that that occurs. Analogously to the workforce participation, the individual contractor would submit an affirmative action plan. We would review the affirmative action plan, and upon completion of that review, we would then issue a certificate. If we found deficiencies within the affirmative action plan, then we would identify those deficiencies. Because of the oversight in the past of this respective committee to the department, I do want to make sure that we're clear as relates to how effective we have been in getting those certificates out. Last legislative session, we moved the language on review of affirmative action certificates from 30 to 15 days of getting notice back out to employers as relates to deficiencies. Currently, the department, about 75% of the affirmative action plans are reviewed in less than 3 days or less. And then in the totality of getting situations in which we identify deficiencies and then getting those responses back, we're able on average to get that done in 13 days. So the process of obtaining a certificate in the affirmative action area, we're exceeding sort of that area of the 15 days. This is even a more streamlined process as relates to equal pay certificates, and I anticipate that we will probably be able to exceed what we're doing in the area of affirmative action review. The language set forth as it relates to conducting a fee of the $150 in the 4 years also aligns with the workforce participation certificate. The rest of the language within the bill that you have before you also borrows heavily from the framework for workforce participation certificates. The idea of information being obtained, we would reviewing that, providing some feedback and technical assistance to the contractor to ensure compliance. To the extent that there would be multiple violation that we would find, we would seek first to ensure that the individual employee or employees were made whole, and we would pursue that as a remedy. The only instance of moving toward a more serious consequence for the contractor would be situations in which there's multiple violations, and also ensuring that there would be no undue hardship to the state. So a very narrow view as it relates to a more draconian remedy beyond just simply pursuing wages for the adversely impacted employees. If there are other questions as it relates to the process for this or within the department, I would entertain those questions.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Hopefully you can help me clarify this, and if this came through a different committee and I did not hear this before, I apologize. Line 1.12 through 1.13. This section does not apply to a contract with the Department of Human Services for the primary purposes of providing health care services. Why?
Commissioner?
Representative Schoen, Chairman Paymar, and members of the committee. In the spirit of collaboration and discussion and trying to reach a compromise, I did have an opportunity to meet with various constituent groups, members of various chamber organizations, members from and advocates representing the healthcare community, Representative Moran, and also Senator Pappas. And in discussing the review process, we thought that it would make sense to exempt this particular class of entities primarily because of the regulation which is already placed on them at the state level as well as the federal level. And we thought that our resources would be better served focusing in our contracting efforts on other state contractors.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Lindsey. So the things that we're doing in the bill are accomplished for them in a different way, meaning that there's other resources ensuring that these things are in place in that particular field. So it makes it cost effective to let them do it versus Department of Human Rights on this issue. So basically, whatever's being done, you guys, it's married together with what you guys are trying to accomplish in your agency, so you feel confident that it is being done within another state agency.
Commissioner Lindsey.
Representative Schoen and Chair Paymar, members of the committee, that is correct.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a number of questions about this bill. First question, I guess, directed to the commissioner. This bill is written, really provides you veto power over state contracts, the way I'm reading it. Is that correct?
Commissioner Lindsey.
Representative and Chair Paymar, members of the committee, I would not say that it provides me with veto power. I'd first have to make a finding of a violation. We would then have to establish that the contractor would not reach some type of settlement agreement with us. After that, we would then have to show some type of either multiple violation, and then we'd also have to show that there'd be no undue hardship before we could even get to the stage of avoiding a contract. So there are quite a number of intermediate steps before that happens. And in the history of the department, I'm unaware of the department taking that step of actually voiding a contract under workforce participation. So it is a very rare instance. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
No, okay. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But in the final analysis, after all those steps, you could veto or void a contract, correct?
Commissioner Lindsey.
Representative and Mr. Chairman Paymar, members of the committee, that is correct. If several steps were made by the contractor to refuse to comply with the law, that is possible.
Okay.
Representative Uglum.
Mr. Chair, thank you. How does this bill balance the disadvantage we're putting on Minnesota businesses versus out-of-state contractors that may bid, such as people from Wisconsin or North Dakota or whatever? Because my reading of this bill shows that they don't have to go through this. It's a considerable cost. How do we square that up?
Commissioner Lindsay.
Representative Chair Paymar, members of the committee, I'm not sure if I'm following that logic within the reading of the bill. So looking at Subdivision 1, it talks about a business in the state or state where the principal place of business. So that would suggest that if you are operating and you've entered into a contract and you have more than 40 employees in a state, that you would be subject to it. So there would be no differential treatment between a Wisconsin business and a Minnesota business. They would be treated the same.
Mr. Chair, that seems a little unclear to me. I think that that wording could use a lot of work. I have another question, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Has anybody, and I think we do have some testifiers, don't we?
Yes, we have.
Later on. But, Commissioner, you've talked to the business community on this. Do you have an estimate of the cost to business in the state of Minnesota with this additional paperwork? And I am all for pay equity and everything else, and you talked about streamlining, and I think that's very important. And the DE-4 makes this bill a better bill than what it was. There's no question about that. But do we have any idea what this is going to cost business?
Commissioner Lindsay.
Representative, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, there's a couple of questions which were contained within your question to me. As to the last question you asked as relates to the respective cost, there would be some costs which would be borne by the company, but if we're talking about them simply supplying a statement, we are probably talking a very de minimis cost, because what we're really talking about is getting information that could probably be sent in one page to two pages. So a very de minimis cost to businesses from compliance.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Well, someone like an Ecolab, I'm not talking about, you know, a small contractor and the burden. I mean, I think that's a very big burden for a small contractor and things, but we have major corporations with major HR facilities that are contracts, that have contracts to this state, and I'm just a little concerned that that this could really upend their HR departments to a great extent and cost a lot of money, but I imagine we'll hear some testimony about that. Mr. Chair, I have another question.
Representative Uglum?
What? How many state contracts are we estimating that this will cover?
Commissioner Lindsay.
Representative Chair Paymar and members of the committee, when I have spoken with individuals within the Department of Administration, the number that has been offered by the Department of Administration is between 1,000 and 1,500 contracts. As relates to your earlier question about the employees, we're talking about the employees which would be born and working on the state contract. So, for example, in your hypothetical about Ecolab, if Ecolab had entered into a contract with the state of Minnesota, we would be talking about the Ecolab employees that would be working on the contract. We're not talking about something global as it relates to every employee of the company.
Mr. Chair, if the commissioner could point that out in the bill, where does it say that?
Commissioner Lindsay.
The conditions of the audit in lines 2.12 through 2.32.
Okay.
Representative Uglum, did that answer your question?
Only, Mr. Chair, only partially, but okay. I'll follow up. Now, Commissioner, you're requesting how many new employees for this to implement this in the fiscal note?
Representative Chair Paymar, members of the committee, we submitted a revised fiscal note, and we are looking for somewhere in the order of 5 employees.
Representative Uglum.
5. Mr. Chair, how many employees do you have now in your department?
Mr. Lindsay.
Representative Chair Paymar and members of the committee, we have 36 and a half full-time equivalents.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would submit that's a huge increase in terms of people in the department. I just have a couple other questions. For Representative Moran, we had an amendment here, the 0944 amendment, which states that contract to a business if it's out of compliance, but would cause a state undue hardship. The determination of undue hardship could be made by the Commissioner of Administration in consulting the Human Rights Department. Why wasn't that amendment offered? Seems like a good amendment.
Yeah. Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think part of this is that we have gone through a lot of revisions from the original bill, and that I believe this language is also included in the D4 amendment. And it just muddled what we're trying to put forward, and just caused a little bit more confusion. So I decided not to move that amendment.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then one final question. With the under Section 2, Subdivision 1, with the statement the business is going to have to comply with Title 7 of the Civil Rights Act, Equal Pay Act of 1963, the Minnesota Human Rights Act, and the Minnesota Equal Pay for Equal Work Law. Why do we even need this bill?
Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair and Representative, what we currently know is that all those laws are on the book, but we also know there's still a great disparity between the pay of women and men, with Caucasian women earning 80 cents to the dollar, and communities of color and rural women around the 60 cents per certain, area. So because there are laws on the book that says if discrimination happens, and if it doesn't, if you believe it is, you can take someone to court. Which just really is a burden on women who are, with over 50% of women who are head of households, raising families, who are in the workforce, and to put that burden on a woman to go to court if they feel as though or believe that they have been discriminated against is a huge burden. So to alleviate that process and really keep companies accountable in a way that we can collect some data, to ensure that it has been done, and to keep businesses who would like to contract with the state accountable to what is in law, we believe that we need to move forward with this type of law.
Mr. Chair, one final follow-up, I guess. Well, I think it's very important that we have pay equity for everyone, and I think the state has been in the forefront of that, and I really believe that under these both federal and state laws we have already, there's plenty of enforcement mechanism, and the burden to business here, the additional paperwork, the additional cost to the state, all your employees that you're going to have to hire over there at Human Rights and things, I really question the need for this, and I know the business community is not happy about this. I think there's been some improvement in the bill. The first bill that we heard in jobs wasn't very good. And so this is an improvement, but I really question whether we need it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kiefer, then Cornish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, so it sounds like there's a problem with who is overseeing compliance and you're not happy with the job they're doing. I'm wondering who is in charge. Is it the Department of Labor? Or who's in charge of the compliance of all these on lines 1.16 or 1.19, those groups?
Commissioner Lindsay.
Representative Kiefer, Chairman Paymar, and members of the committee, there are various agencies which have responsibility and jurisdiction for the enforcement of these respective laws. You have the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. You have the Department of Labor. You have our department. So there are a variety of different agencies which are involved in this process.
Representative Keeper.
Mr. Chair, going back to Rep. Ulam's statements, we need to find a solution on how we can ensure compliance with all of these agencies that we already have in place. I think that might be a better solution. I also wanted to thank Rep. Moran for really working hard to streamline the bill, because I know I kind of asked you a lot of tough questions in the Jobs Committee, but I think your answers are more definitive now. And so I want to thank you for continuing to make this a better bill.
Representative Cornyn.
Representative Moran, I just don't like the bill. I think it's like one of these bills with good intentions, like a number of them, equity and equality and a number of them, but we should take that shotgun approach. And the amendment to A14 actually is, it was kind of comical in a way, because, and I was wondering if that's why it wasn't offered, because it talks about an undue hardship of the state. And if it's an undue hardship in the state, then there's an example made or an exception made, but they don't talk about undue hardship of the business. And it's just a kind of a comical amendment, I thought, because it talks about a burden to the state, and they don't worry about the business. And I really worry that it's the typical thing that usually conservative Republicans talk about, a bureaucratic nightmare, and you always hear us beat the drum on bureaucracies. Here we got about four agencies in charge, and we can't get control of it. So what we do, instead of making one of those agencies be more efficient, we sign it yet to another one and spend more money. And Commissioner Lindsay, sorry that some of us didn't recognize you. You continue to change your appearance of a goatee or something there. But Commissioner, right now some of your employees are complaining about being overworked and overtime and this and that, and just overloaded, and in a letter to me. And so how are you going to justify putting all this work on them? Because with all those businesses you talked about, I would have rather seen the bill say if the business had a problem or they were flagged for having a previous problem, something, then they would have to prove something. But the way you've got it here is that they have to bring in a certificate of compliance with no previous errors, it seems like. But it's a lot of questions, but basically, do you get the gist?
Commissioner Lindsay.
Representative Cornish, Chair Paymar, members of the committee. I'm not aware of the letter to which you refer. But to the questions and sort of the spirit of this, when I came here, when you were the chair of this respective committee, one of the challenges you put out to the department is to be effective and to work more cooperatively with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And at that point in time, I had indicated that there were more than 100,000 cases in the backlog of the EEOC, and that we as a state agency were partnering with the EEOC to address and ensure that justice was for those employees, but also that there were no additional burdens to businesses. And in that time frame, we have issued nearly 800 determinations last year, and in the three-year period of time, we have issued more determinations in that three-year period of time than any six-year period of time in the prior 20 years without any additional increase in funding. That goes to this point, an issue as it relates to working more cooperatively with the federal agencies, being very efficient with the resources that we have. We still have an issue as it relates to pay, especially as it relates to women in the workforce, and also underlining that, women of color within the workforce. The number is even far greater for those individuals. So to the extent that we can coordinate our respective resources and look at that, the process which is really laid out, the representative's correct. The state has been a leader on this. Hopefully that we will find in this process that state contractors are also a leader in that process. But to the extent that they're not, that we should take steps to deal with that and address it so we can maintain our position of leadership.
We'll take Representative Johnson, and then we have testifiers, and then we can open it up for questions again.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, I know this, if I recall the other day, we dealt a little bit with this in civil law. On the amendment on lines, the DE amendment, lines 3.16 and 3.12 deals with data.
And I thought, if my memory recalls correctly, we tried to figure out which section of the data laws of Chapter 13, whether it's 13, 13A, 13B, or 13C, that was going to be protected under. And that's not in this amendment. And then also need to find out the same line, how long that data is going to be stored and how long before it's going to be destroyed, or would it end up being public. Without the referencing which chapters and stuff, I think we could have a problem with that.
Commissioner, do you want to address that?
Representative Chair Paymar, members of the committee, the information that would be public would be on lines 3.20 to 3.21. So the decision to grant, revoke, or suspend the certificate would be public data, but the underlying data would not be public data. To the extent that it would be no longer in the possession of the department, then we would utilize the same rules that we use currently for workforce certificate information. So we're talking a short period of time of approximately 3 years.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I just want to make sure, because it's a good possibility you could have financial information as far as with pay equity on employees, what their pay status is. So I want to make sure that data is protected.
Representative Chair Paymar and members of the committee, if you look at Minnesota Administrative Rule 5000, 3400 to 3600, there is extensive language there which talks about the means by which an employer and any particular proceeding with the commissioner can ask for information to be protected under seal or to take additional steps to protect their information if they believe that it's confidential, a trade secret, or proprietary information. So there already exists a process by which that can occur, and I'm also aware of instances in which that has happened while I have been the commissioner to ensure that we take steps to properly protect. And I'm not aware of any instance in which we have had a problem handling anyone's information.
Okay, so we have several people that signed up to speak. I don't know if they are all here, but I'll just go down the line here and see. Patty Tangi. Either get another chair or that's good. Here. Commissioner, do you have something to hand out to or no? Ms. Tangi, if you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, I'm Patty Tangi. I am here as CEO of my own company, Open Workplace, which is a limited liability company. And I am here to testify in support of Senate House File 2373. In my work as a private citizen, I consult with women to help them get pay raises. We actually work together to frame the ask, to do the ask, and to get the pay raise. And I'm here to tell the story of one of my clients who wishes to remain anonymous. She works for a construction firm here in Minnesota and she has access to payroll data. A privilege most of us don't have. She's a valued employee and partners with her company leadership to make strategic leadership decisions for their firm. Even though she's a full-time valued member of her management team, she was paid less than the male construction supervisors working seasonal part-time work. So once she decided to move forward to ask for a pay raise, which is a very courageous act, we put together a proposal to call attention to our management team the tremendous work that she was doing. And lo and behold, they agreed. And so she did get her $20,000 pay raise, a mileage reimbursement, in addition to her 401k, just to bring her up to the same level of pay and benefits as the full-time year-round, the part-time seasonal work of the other construction workers at her firm. And I wanted to call attention to a 2012 Bloomberg report, which basically says human resource people do believe there is a pay gap, but they don't believe that it's here in their own firm. So, for instance, they asked, do gender-based pay gaps exist by industry? In the manufacturing industry, 22% of the human resource people said No, it doesn't exist in my company, but yes, it exists in other companies. In the financial service, 15% said, no, it doesn't exist in my company, but 70% said, yes, it does exist in other companies. So there's just the, there's something going on here, and this is why I support this bill, because I really think it's time for us to just examine our pay practices, at least in the contractor pool. And because there are unintended biases that exist in our pay practices, and my client is an example of one of them. So I do support this bill, and I really wish that contractors will start reexamining their pay practices as a result, especially as they intend the unintended consequences of underpayment of female employees. And I thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you for your testimony. Next is Aviva Breen.
Aviva has a flat tire and she cannot be here.
Okay. Melissa Rapan. Sure, I'm not pronouncing that right, but
it's Rapan.
Good morning. My name is Melissa Rafan, as Commissioner Lindsay pointed out. And I am a partner with Dorsey and Whitney, practicing in the area of employment law. And I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Employment Law Council, which is a group of 10 of the state's largest employers. And I'm here to speak on House File 2373. We certainly do appreciate the changes that have been made, and we are continuing to work with the authors, but we do have very significant concerns, and we would need to see language which addresses those concerns, and I thought I might briefly just speak about a couple of them. The first is there is a very significant concern about cost under the current wording, and to the point that was raised earlier, it does cost tens of thousands of dollars to ensure compliance. No question about that, if employers take it seriously. In addition, in the current language, there are many phrases that are very problematic in terms of ambiguity, in terms of internal inconsistency, in terms of lack of clarity. And all of that obviously makes it very difficult to work with and very difficult to understand. Employers are already protected. Well, let me say this. Employers are already required to comply, and employees are already protected under a number of existing laws, under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, under the Equal Pay Act, under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, and under the Minnesota Equal Pay for Equal Work Act. That compliance is already required. And so we are not sure why this additional step is being asked of employers. I believe that the commissioner indicated that DHS, the carve-out, the exception, is already covered, and we understand that other employers are also covered under federal and state existing law. In addition, in response to an earlier question, the language in this act is not aligned with federal law. And federal contractors must comply with Office of Federal Contract compliance programs and must make certain certifications, but the certifications they are required to do vary significantly from the certifications being asked here, and that will also create inconsistency. For all of those reasons, we have significant concerns and currently oppose the language of the bill. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Cornish.
If you can answer for me, when do you think the question of pay equity, the first was ever raised, how long ago, about men versus women in pay equity?
Well, I think
Ms.
we...
Fan.
In history.
I apologize, Mr. Speaker. I think the question of pay equity, frankly, as worded in that way, is a little bit ambiguous. I think we're talking, as I've heard testimony on the bill, there have been two very different concepts that have been conflated, which has been problematic. Equal pay for equal work, as that has been defined in the Equal Pay Act, goes back to the late 70s, early 80s. In terms of the comparable worth concept in the government sector, I believe the same time frame, but I'm not sure. Is that answer the question?
Well, it helps, Mr. Chair, and ma'am, it helps me define what I'm going to say a little bit. My point, I guess, is that this is ages, decades, century old, this argument, and that the lady that testified before you said the best we could come up with is something is going on here. So we've looked at this for 100 years. Nobody knows what's going on, and the frustration is among some members here is that here we go again. We don't even know what's going on, but yet we're going to go after businesses and make them prove that they're okay before we settle this problem. And it's ages old. We've got agencies and statutes that cover it already, and here we're adding one more because we think something's going on. I guess that's my point, Mr. Chair. That's why I don't like the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Moran.
Thank you. Well, something is going on, and I think that is the purpose of this bill, to collect data, to collect a report from any business that decides to contract with the state. A big part of what we're doing here is about collecting the data so that we can become more informed about why the inequities exist in pay between men and women. Some of the language that the testifier talked about is not included in this bill. Comfortable work is no longer a part of this bill. Pay equity is no longer a part of this bill. It is about equal pay for equal work. We have refined this bill going forward around the issues that you addressed. In reference to the cost, and I hear you state they will cost thousands of dollars, but what I also hear from the business sector is that we are doing this. We are abiding by all the rules. And if that is the case, then the $150 it takes to get the certificate is a cost. But I am bewildered about where this huge amount. We're only asking three other questions for the certificate. Three questions that would maybe be a page or two to be that would need to come from the businesses. So I'm not quite sure where the thousands of dollars that the cost to businesses come from. But what we do know, what is really clear to us, is that women are being undervalued for the work that they do in comparison to men. That data do exist. So our hope is that we can collect data here in the state of Minnesota to help us kind of figure out where are those gaps and why those gaps exist. And even more, to find out where the gaps exist, but to begin to value the work of women so that women are paid at the same rate as our male counterparts.
Representative Cornish had a follow-up question.
A question for Commissioner Lindsay or Representative Moran or anybody. Have any other the departments that cover this same subject requested help? And said, we can't do our job efficiently, we need help, or we don't have enough employees, we don't know what we're doing, and there's no need for us anymore, you take over, or anything like that. If any of the agencies that cover these subjects collaterally, or the statutes, have they asked for help and said that they can't do their job?
Mr. Pan, I think why don't we let the commissioner come back up because she's made her testimony. Commissioner, do you want to respond to this?
Thank you, Chair. Paymar, Representative Cornish, and members of the committee. I would say no one has, from the EEOC or the Department of Labor, has said that they're throwing up their hands and they're abandoning their work in this respective area. But at the conferences that I do attend with the EEOC and the Department of Labor, they are looking for greater partnership with state agencies, what we refer to as a fair employment practice agency within state, to focus in on this respective area. And I would even say that sometimes this one goes hand in hand to public safety, because sometimes where we find underpayment of wages, we find that individuals sometimes might be masquerading or engaging in sex trafficking or other nefarious things. We have issued determinations within the past year by starting our examination on pay on the wages being paid, and then we have found other nefarious things.
Mr. Cornish, we've got a couple more
Mr.
people
Lindsay,
who want to testify also.
Thank you for your answer, but the problem I deal with is the determination of partnership. I have no problem with that, but partnership here is turning into duplicity, and that's what I object to. So,
Okay, we have two more people that signed up anyway. Joe Larson. Before we do that, Representative Simon, do you have some guests here? Do you want to introduce them?
Yes. Thank you, members, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. I just wanted to just recognize folks who are with us today. There was another similar group here the other day. We have some students from St. Louis Park High School who are participating in the Voice of the People program for the Minnesota Historical Society. So I hope you'll join me in welcoming them. Thanks.
Awesome. Okay, Ms. Larson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, my name is Jill Larson. I represent the Minnesota Business Partnership. The partnership is made up of about 100 of Minnesota's largest employers, many of which would be affected by this bill. I appreciate your time. And I'm kind of honored to be testifying in front of your committee at your last hearing because I've never testified in front of your committee before. So thank you. I first want to start out by thanking Representative Moran and Commissioner Lindsay. They have been very good about working with us. We've had several meetings on this language. This bill is improved from the original bill, but as Ms. Rafan testified earlier, we still do have some substantial concerns. I just want to make a couple of clarifying points, because everything Ms. Rafan said I agree with. There's some questions about the carving out of some of the businesses that do business with in healthcare. We're fine with that, of course, but I think it does sort of beg the question, because as was mentioned, many of my employers also have contracts with the federal government, and if that's the case, they are already subject to very extensive rules and auditing procedures with respect to compliance with the Equal Pay Act. And so I think our concern with this language is that it is not only just duplicative, but it is both duplicative and different at the same time, in that the requirements that we're under to comply with the federal law and the auditing procedures are not the same as what's in this bill. And in terms of the costs that have been talked about, the cost is not so much in issuing the statement that we are in compliance with these laws, because I want to be clear, our members take very seriously their obligation, their responsibility to comply with the equal pay laws that are on both the state and the federal books, very seriously. And they're going to do everything in their power to make sure they are in compliance. But the cost that has been suggested, I think, is in the audit language. And there are federal audits that are currently conducted are very arduous, they are lengthy, and they are quite costly. I think just a sort of a run-of-the-mill audit, somebody told me, could run $60,000 to $80,000. Now, that might not be a big deal for a really large company, but it is for a smaller company, and it could be much more expensive depending on how much information is collected. So I think that's just our caution, is that the audit language, and that while you're in the middle of an audit, is your contract at risk? And are employers going to be willing to enter into a contract with the state if there's this uncertainty of, will my contract be at risk if I'm under audit? And if you're entering into a really large contract for millions and millions of dollars, and if there's a chance that it might be revoked or it's uncertain, let's say you enter into a $20 million contract, which is not uncommon, and it gets revoked halfway through the contract, what happens? Is that employer out of that half of the contract? What happens? And so I think and Representative Moran has suggested she will continue work with us, and I appreciate that. I just wanted to clarify some of the questions that were asked. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Larson. Next is Representative Slocum has a question. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You stated that the business partnership and the businesses that belong to this collaborative, that they're doing everything that they can to be in compliance. I've been working on this issue since 1975. Why is there still a wage gap? Can you answer that, please?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slocum, I wish we had about a three-hour hearing that we could talk about the issue, because I think the issue of the so-called gender pay gap is a real issue. There are various studies saying that the gap is 20%, and other studies that say when you actually take into account several mitigating factors, it's more like 3 to 5. I don't think we have time today to get into that, but it's a legitimate question. Our our employers have internal programs to try to analyze their own practices to make sure that they are addressing that. So we do not disagree that this is an issue that needs to be addressed. I think our question is this the right way to go about it in terms of this kind of a regulatory process?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slocum.
If they have their own internal processes and we have these all these mechanisms in place, why? Why is there still this gap? And I don't care if it's 3-5% or 80 cents on the dollar. It hasn't moved in the years, years and years. And I love this bill. And it's way past time. It draws attention to the issue. I just don't understand, if all these processes are in place, why is there a gap after years? Sorry, that was more of a statement than a question. It was getting a little hot under the collar, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Beth Cardone. Oh, sorry. Cardone. No.
Mr. Chair, members of the community, my name is Beth Cardone, so you're very close. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you so much for allowing my testimony today. I won't repeat the comments that have been already stated. Certainly agree with the testimony from Ms. Larson as well as Ms. Rafan on this. We do appreciate all the work and discussions that we have had on this bill with the authors. And so we appreciate their willingness to listen to us. But we do have, and we're still, language is still problematic, as you heard, and we are opposed to this bill. We do believe it's going to increase cost, as well as there's still a lot of confusion how this will really impact businesses trying to comply with this in the nature of the changes between current federal and state law that already deal with discrimination and the new requirements of the certificate as well as the audit provisions. I will focus my comments more on the impact to those smaller companies. There was some testimony regarding the EEO-1 requirement for federal contracts. Those requirements are required currently if you have 100 or more employees, or if you're a federal contractor of 50 or more. So I do believe for those businesses, there's a gap now between those. If you're not a federal contractor, between 50 and 100, this would be putting this new requirement on those small and mid-sized companies within Minnesota who want to do the business with the state. New systems that they will have to put in place to make sure that they're complying with this new requirement. So this is a new cost, especially for those of small and mid-sized companies, and I would just want to be clear on that new requirement. And we do disagree on the de minimis cost implications that was mentioned earlier. We believe the cost could be substantial, mentioned just because the differences, and you want to make sure whatever is put in place, our companies are going to do their best to comply with this new law. And they do require potential significant changes to HR systems. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and questions. Okay. Anyone else in the audience wish to speak in favor or in opposition to the bill? Mr. Wells, can you just review the fiscal note for us real quickly?
Mr. Chair and members, there is a fiscal note in your packet. However, it is not current. This was done to the original version of the bill as introduced. The bill before you is the second engrossment. A fiscal note request was requested on the 1E version. That was not completed. We had a request put in the bill as introduced. The bill before you is the second engrossment. A fiscal note request was requested on the 1E version. That was not completed. We had a request put in today, I believe, to the amendment that was adopted, but has not yet been completed because that was only entered into the system a few hours ago. I believe the commissioner testified that they would be looking for 5 FTEs and not the 1 in the fiscal note that's before you.
Comments or questions before we vote on the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Uglin.
Just one final comment. I kind of, from the family standpoint, have a unique perspective on this because my daughter is an HR professional in a Fortune 500 company here in the state of Minnesota. So I can tell you, Representative Morant, when we're sitting around the dinner table or whatever, we've talked extensively about this. I think Representative Cornish had some good points here about this being generational and taking some time. We all want this to happen, and there is room for improvement, obviously, in the workplace. It's just that the cost perspective to individual businesses, and when we say, well, here's a certificate and it costs, whatever, $150 or so, that's just the tip of the iceberg, and we have to realize that when we vote on this bill. Because in a big company or even a little company, it's going to cost a lot of money just to do this. Because big companies sometimes are just almost as bureaucratic as we are around here. And they will say, well, what about the audit? And when you've got millions of dollars on the line, there will be huge dollars spent in making sure that they're right. So it's an additional cost to business, and it's a big cost. Thank you.
Thank you, President Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, when I first heard this bill a couple weeks ago, it was actually more of a comparable pay bill, which is different. So, I appreciate that change because I saw that as a real compliance nightmare. So I think we're going in the right direction. I wanted to address Rep. Slocum a little bit. You asked why. And Rep. Moran and I worked together as freshmen on the Education Reform Committee, and we heard over and over and over again about the achievement gap. And I really think that's where some of this is stemming from. And until we figure out how to close that achievement gap, and really, I think the key to financial freedom, economic security is a good education. And then, you know, for women, we have babies. And so I'm going to throw in one more thing is we need to be really strategic on our family planning. But I think the education piece is so important. And so I'd like to continue seeing great reforms in the state to try to close that achievement gap. And then maybe this next thing will come naturally. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
One second, Representative Johnson. To this point, since Representative Slocum, I
hold out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiefer, I appreciate the education reference, and I love to see more girls in GEMS and in STEM programs. But I don't think that's it. And you know, we talk fiscal notes here, and the cost to business, and the cost to this and that. I'd love to see a fiscal note on what women have given up economically and what their families and their children have given up. That would be one heck of a fiscal note. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran. There's quite a few things that I have some issues with this bill. I think the cost to businesses, which will be passed on in their contracts, will end up costing us tax dollars as well. But right now I'm a little more concerned about the data issue that I brought up. And I'm hoping that as the bill goes forward, you'd work with Representative Holmberg on getting the right wording in to codify the statutes to protect that data. I would love to help out, but I wish I knew half of what she has forgotten as her time here, as she knows those statutes so well.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we would like to respond to the cost piece of this bill, and I would defer to the commissioner.
Commissioner?
Sure. You want me to also address the other?
In the audit.
Okay. A couple of points which were raised within the questioning. The specific exemption within the Department of Human Services, there's also a connection as it relates to the money which is appropriated. So, for example, when this body appropriates money to intermediate care facilities for individuals with a diagnosis of mental retardation or identified as ICFMRs, you attach how much can be given to the actual direct workers and then how much can be given to the executives within that organization. So that narrowing as it relates to the pot of money makes them different as state contractors as opposed to contractors on the multi-use stadium that's going up in Minneapolis. There is no tie to that respective money in that same way. That's why there was a discussion again, a couple of days ago, and I thought compromise was reached between the various proponents of the bill and then those also on the other side of this respective bill. That's why that language exists within Subdivision 1. Material breach of contract, any time in which actually a contractor engages in a material breach of contract, the bid awarding agency has the ability to void the contract. And in the private marketplace, that also exists. So really all you are saying here is that the violation of the law as it relates to paying women has been violated so substantially that it constitutes a material breach of the contract, therefore justifying the breach of voiding the contract. That's not a dramatic departure at all as it relates to what exists currently within civil law or even currently exists within state law in contracting. The third point, the cost of the audit. It also costs the agency some money as well. So when we have to be judicious with our resources as it relates to who we audit. Currently, when we make a finding of determination, more than 95% of those times, we resolve those cases before actually getting into court. So the cost of an audit when we get to that point is relatively narrow, and we also are focused on it. I would say that we have, as a department, have tried to reach to work with businesses. I appreciate Ms. Rafan and the Minnesota Employment Law Council and others that have asked me to come and speak to those respective groups, and I've extended the invitation and the opportunity to narrow discovery requests, which are served by the Department of Human Rights when we conduct an investigation. And I think that we have made substantial progress in limiting the cost on both sides of the aisle. And we also are sensitive to the issue as to small companies. We don't audit the same way what we're doing currently for the multi-use stadium in Minneapolis the same way that we would audit a smaller company. We do take a more strategic approach. The last point, Representative Moran and I have been in audiences when we talk about the differences as relates to disparities which exist. Dr. Algernon Austin, who was here 2 years ago, said that the disparities which exist as relates to race discrimination, gender discrimination, is generally described in two ways. There's an education component, but there's also a subtle discrimination component. And we have to have groups who hear both of those as the reasons moving us forward to solving those disparities. It's not just all education. It's not all just discrimination. It's a little bit of both, and we all need to hear that.
Thank you for your testimony, Commissioner. Representative Moran, do you want to have the final word here?
Yes. And so pay equity in the public sector has been around for 30 years. But what we also know is that 80% of women are working in the private sector. And what we do know that there's a gap, a pay gap. And I am even more appalled to know that between women of color, the gap is even larger. And so we bring this bill forth that is way overdue in a way that we can collect data in the state of Minnesota to find why that gap persists. And if it doesn't, with the businesses who want to contract with the state of Minnesota, then that is a great thing. We will lift them up. But I have gone through great deeds to compromise and refine this bill with the private sector. I just ask that you can support this going forward and that we can begin collecting data to find out why the pay gap exists. Thank you.
Thank you. The chair will renew his motion to refer House File 2373 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Moran. We are in recess until 4 o'clock.
Chairman Paymar, I would be remiss if I did not also pass on how much I've also appreciated working with you and also the former chair, Representative Cornish. I know that there have been some interesting conversations between the department and ourselves, but I do appreciate both your leadership on that issue.
Thank you, Commissioner Lindsay. We're in recess till 4 or until after session.
Here?
In room 500 North. Committee is back in session, so we will.
So, you called the meeting to order, didn't you?
I did indeed.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And you know, Mr. Chair, this morning a lot of people said a lot of nice things about you. Some were true, some were not. You know, Mr. Chair, I go back to, as you know, back to the Proctor days, and you go back to Duluth days, you know, and I was a mayor up there, and you were on the city council, and I grew up listening to a guy named Gordy Paymar. Gordy Paymar is Representative Paymar's dad, who was a weather forecaster for, I think he started when Moses was born. And so I know the Paymar name well, and when I got down here, Representative Paymar, Chair Paymar, you know, I asked to be on your committee to start with, and then lo and behold, I was able to sit next to you on the House floor. And, you know, as I was sitting there today, just kind of reminiscing about the discussions and dialogues we've had, and because we have not always been on the same page with a number of issues. But I think of the times that you and I have talked, and the nice things that were said about you this morning, but one of the things that hasn't been said about you is even when you disagree with people, you still have respect, you still have integrity, you still have passion about what you believe in, and have dedicated yourself to so many great causes and been a champion of the people that most need our help and your help, and you've done a tremendous job. And as I'm sitting there with you on one side of me and Lyndon Carlson on the other side of me, been blessed with that for years now, I just thought, what am I going to do next year? You know, when I don't have Representative Paymar sitting over here with me, and he's sitting somewhere probably like in Costa Rica doing something. you know, I just wanted to make sure, Representative Paymar, that I know a guy named Gordy Paymar is looking down with so much pride in his heart to know what his son did in his career down at the legislature. And thank you for being who you are and what you have given to so many people, including this freshman legislator a long time ago, and allowed me to grow as a legislator. So I want to say that today.
Thank you very much, Representative Ward. That's very kind. It's getting harder and harder to complete this.
Are you going to change your mind?
No. So, thank you, Representative Ward. It was very, very kind. Okay, Representative Hillstrom, do you want to move House File? Oh, yes, that's good. We're not actually moving it. So this is an informational hearing on House File 2400. Do you want to do that one first?
So thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for actually coming for an informational hearing after 4 o'clock. I really appreciate it. This is a really important issue that I think this committee needs to hear about, and one that really needs to be addressed. Members, the food service currently in our prison system is contracted out. And there has been an issue that was brought to my attention in addition to it being done by contractors. We actually had a failed health inspection on Friday. And so I have a number of testifiers that would really like to talk about the issue. And this bill actually really does just bring the food service back to be done by the food. So with me is Julie Blyle, and I'd like to turn it over to her.
Ms. Blyle, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm Julie Blyle, Legislative Director for House Council 5. I can't miss this opportunity to thank you to Representative Paymar, who I've had the opportunity to work with since I first started here at the legislature, and a thank you to myself, all of ABSME. We very much appreciate the working relationship we've had, and thank you for everything that you've done in your service, and thank you for the hearing today. We have a number of folks here from the correctional facilities that can tell you firsthand the day-to-day goings on with regard to both bills that are in front of you. We'd like to thank Representative Hillstrom for authoring these bills. And to begin with, I am going to turn it over to Tim Henderson, who is our field representative and also a correctional officer. He will begin, and we also have with us a few other folks that will testify with regard to House File 2400.
Thank you, Ms. Blau. Thank you for the kind words. Mr. Henderson, do you want to come up?
Mr. Chair, if we could get some of them to all start to come up so that we are prepared and are respectful of the committee's time.
Mr. Henderson, welcome to the committee. If you can state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Representative Paymar and committee members. My name is Tim Henderson, and I worked for the Department of Corrections for 19 years as a correctional officer. And now I work for AASME Council 5 as a field representative. I'm the corrections liaison for the union, and I work closely with DOC management at all levels on various issues that arise in the course of our work. I work to prepare the legislation in front of you today by gathering factual data from the correctional staff at all correctional facilities. House File 2400 is our food service bill to prohibit outsourcing of food service and bring this work back to state classifications already covered under the multi-master collective bargaining agreement. This legislation is not about the quantity of food the offenders eat, but deals with the quality of service and food which is being provided and served. The food quality has become terrible, and the lack of preparation and careless safety and security practices by the current vendor is a current security risk in all facilities except Togo, St. Cloud, and Red Wing. The food is being served, and what is promised on the menu is not being met. The results of these cost-saving measures are compromising the safety and security of our prisons, which is why we are bringing this legislation forward to you today. I can speak broadly on the issues and concerns my correctional officers deal with on a daily basis, and we have an officer here today. We only have one that's going to testify on the food service one, and I have two that's going to testify on the staffing one, House File 2401. I look forward to answering any of your questions today on the outsourcing of the food service. But before we go to questions, I just have a couple emails that were sent in the course of, say, the last 8 months, and they're very brief. Just an FYI, as I was doing rounds through the bakery area, I noticed a lot of cookies were burnt to the point of being black. I stopped and asked the offenders if they needed to go into the pig bucket, as they were very burnt. The offender replied, "No, Dawn told us to serve them," and proceeded to put them in the Lexons to be served. We may get a lot of kites because of the other end of the spectrum. Other cookies were raw, and there was no happy medium on them. Another one. We are completely out of walk and wash, and have been for over a week. This is used to clean the floors. At breakfast, milk was expired, all of it. At lunch, they ran out of buns. At lunch, they ran out of potato salad and carrots. We ran out of cookies tonight before South D finished coming through for their meal. Apples were put in their place for the rest of the evening meal. Can you imagine telling your kids they're going to have a cookie and then you give them an apple? Hello, just to clarify, 60 cases of milk, 50 cartons per case, 3,000 cartons of milk, were sitting aside with a label on it, outdated. Let it be known it sat outside the cooler for a good 3 hours today. This is not counting the four Camrys they dumped this morning, too. The intention is to use this milk for tomato soup for tomorrow's lunch and whatever else they can find to use it in. And then the State Health Department was here this morning. This is the most recent one at Rush City. One of the coolers was under temp, so they are currently throwing away roast beef, about $1,000 worth, and everything in that cooler. The question the officer had is, who took the temps and where is the cooler temp documentation? Those cooler temps are being taken every day, a couple times a day. This should have been reported and taken care of before 10:30 a.m. in the morning, not to mention all the other items in that cooler, veggies, bologna, and whatever else. 19 pans of bread pudding was also thrown away. So those are just a couple emails. I emailed Julie Blyle, and I think she sent them to Representative Hillstrom, and we had about 80 of them in there. And I keep getting them on a weekly basis. So if there's any questions that you have on the food service for any of the facilities, I can answer those at this time.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Henderson.
Mr.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We also have some of the health inspector who actually did the inspection here. If there are questions specifically on that.
Okay. So, which facility was this that the inspection failed at? Was that fit?
That was Rush City.
That was Rush City. I see. Okay.
Our main problems across the state are with Faribault, Stillwater, Lionel Lakes, Rush City, and Moose. We actually had 160 cases of offenders suffered from salmonella poisoning last summer in Stillwater and Lionel Lakes.
Okay. And the name of the food service company?
Aviance.
Aviance?
Aviance. A-V-I-A-N-D-S. They're actually out of Roseville, Minnesota.
Okay. And did they know about this hearing today, Representative Hillstrom?
Mr. Chair, I did not invite anyone to the hearing.
There are representatives from the department here that I'd like to call up after we hear from the rest of your testifiers. Who else is next?
Tim. It'll be Tim, Officer Tim Hagg. Step aside.
Welcome to the committee. Well, please state your name for the record.
Tim Hagg. Prior to my employment as a corrections officer, I worked in food service at Rush City for 2 years. I was fired when I applied for the position of corrections officer. I applied to become an officer and was in the hiring process when 2 days later the contract staff came up with a new policy stating that if you had applied to become a DOC employee, you would be forfeiting your employment with the contract staff. Since I had applied prior to signing that policy, I signed the policy stating that, you know, if I apply for it, then I would forfeit my job. My supervisor at the time stated, if I apply for the job, don't even bother telling him. But 2 days later, I was called to the office by the assistant food director of the contract company, and he informed me that they were informed by a reputable state employee that I had applied to become an officer. Because I did that, they took my job away from me and fired me. 2 days later, I applied for another job. I had my exit interview on a Tuesday with them. They said I was rehirable, but at the time I was the assistant food service director when they fired me, and I was informed by staff at Rush City that that position had already been filled. They said I was rehirable, but I knew I wasn't going to get the assistant food service job back. During my time with the contract staff, running out of food was a constant problem. And the food service company teaches the food service staff that security and food are two separate things. An example of this would be, there was once a fight out in B Dining. I asked the staff that was out there why they had not activated an ICS. They said, it's not my job.
Is there anything else you want to tell the committee?
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Is there anyone else that wants to testify from... Did you say you had someone from... Health Department here, or
just to answer question if there are questions from the inspection, Mr. Chair.
Well, yeah, I'd like to. If someone's here from the Health Department, let's hear from them about what you found. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Committee members, my name is Colleen Paulus. I'm manager of the food pools and lodging program.
And And you did the inspection, or you are?
No, actually, one of my staff members did the inspection. Nicole did, but I've talked to her about this situation.
Just review it real quickly.
Okay, for Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm looking at the report that's dated March 20th, 2014, and start with the physical facility design and construction. There's a violation that's noted about the tile floor. If you'll notice that that is something that's been on the report since 2012. The next item is in regards to microbial control, hot and cold folding. It was noted again in the 2014 inspection that there were some temperature violations that occurred at the previous inspection in March of 2013. At the time of this inspection in just last week, the inspector did have to throw off the fluid that was out of temperature in the cooler. And the next item, it talks about cooling logs, and that is one of the recommendations that we make when there are equipment problems, is that management should be taking temperatures of the coolers and checking them every day to make sure that the product is being held correctly. At this situation, it was also observed that the roast beef that was cooked the night before was at 54 degrees. And this is a situation where we get very concerned about, because even though it is a cooked product, it goes through the danger zone and it can create an environment where it will grow different organisms that will make people sick. The next item is, again, it talks about cooling. It's about the roast beef again, and then it talks about the roast beef was discarded. There was also an observation on the next item about cooked burgers in the steam table. They were at 133 degrees, and burgers on the holding cabinet were at 130, and they should be at 140 or higher. The next item, again, was talking about the walk-in cooler. And as I was talking to the inspector, the cooler had different areas that were, some areas of the cooler were in were at the proper temperature. Other parts of the cooler were at out of temperature. So there is definitely a maintenance issue that was noted during this inspection. And then, as you can see, the next list of items on page 3 are just the different temperatures of, she took different product temperatures for the inspection, noted the temperatures as she went through the inspection. And again, things that are cold should be at 41 degrees or less.
So, Ms. Paulus, how often did you, I think we can see the rest of the report here. I'm just,
sure.
How often do you make these inspections?
At this facility, it's on an annual basis. So
do you randomly just show up, or
yeah.
Do they?
Excuse me.
So you just show up and inspect.
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members, we make unannounced inspections.
And I'm just trying to find, is there a record of problems at this facility or with this vendor? Trying to get the dates here, I'm looking at.
Sure, Mr. Chair, committee members. There, yes, on the first page it does talk about 2012 as being a problem. There is also problems from the previous year. And that were not corrected. Sometimes what happens in an inspection is that even though they may correct some product temperature in one area, it'll be noted again as a violation if they don't have all the temperatures under control in another area. So in this situation, it does show that the operator has had difficulty with maintaining temperatures.
I'm just curious about how the seriousness of the, obviously it's a serious problem, but I, you know, when a community's health, like in St. Paul, the health inspections of restaurants come up with, it seems like a lot of, in my own community, there were a lot of restaurants that had violations. Would these be equivalent to those kinds of violations at restaurants where they're given warnings about certain health infractions?
Mr. Chair, yes. These are the exact same type of inspection report, the same type of violations. We use the exact same report for inspecting both this facility and those.
Are there questions of Ms. Paulus and Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Collis, one question I have on these reports, when they're issued, are they issued to the company that has the contract, and is there a copy given to the management of the prison as well?
Ms. Paulus.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, it is issued to the company that is licensed, and what I have learned during this hearing is that I think we don't have a proper license for this facility. As you note on page one, it says operator, and it says contingent workforce solution, so that must have been the prior operator. And what I learned today is that Avion is the current operator, and we do not have a license for that operator.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, since it appears that quite a few of these issues are equipment-related issues, do you know if the company that's doing the food service, do they own the equipment, or does the state of Minnesota own the equipment that's malfunctioning? And if it's been brought to their attention that it's malfunctioning, has anything been done to get that equipment fixed?
Let's pause. Do you know, or should we bring someone from the department out?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm not sure on that. Who owns the equipment?
Let's bring them. Why don't we have someone from the department come up? Go into a what?
An enforcement action.
What does that mean? Ms. Paulus.
Mr. Chair, committee members, as we have a process that we follow when we cite violations, so such as the inspection report, we would give notice to the operator if they're operating without a license. We've given them the opportunity to get the license. If they don't get the license, then we have an administrative enforcement process that we follow.
I'm sorry, I have to leave. But Representative Rosenthal, would you take over?
And Mr. Chair, just for information, the equipment is owned by the state.
Mr. Chair, before Mr. Representative Paymar leaves, I just want to thank him. As a freshman down here, I want to thank you for all the work you've done and things you've taught me. Although we have not always agreed on things, you've always been fair, and I want to thank you for that.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
I echo those sentiments, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Welcome
to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Terry Carlson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Facilities Division of the Department of Corrections.
Deputy Chair. Commissioner, did you want to talk about the equipment and who owns it and how it's maintained and that kind of?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. The equipment for our food service operations is owned by the state of Minnesota, and You know, the food service function is really a partnership between food service staff, be it at one of our facilities that has a contract for the food service operation or the state employees. So it's a partnership between the food service staff, the maintenance staff, the safety staff in our facilities, and also the security staff who work in that area to make sure that it's safe, secure, efficient, providing good food for the offender population.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, am under a time constraint. I just, as I've been looking this over and listening to kind of what's going on here and reading through some of the material, I need to preface my comments by telling the committee and the members and the folks that came today that I have an extensive background in the restaurant industry. Long before my public safety career of 26 years, I cooked in restaurants, actual restaurants, not fast food. Not that that's not real food. Just for the record, it's in the microphone. For 7 years, full-time. So I know what it's like to spend long hours on your feet in hot, sweaty, greasy kitchens. I can clearly relate to a lot of what's going on here. As a legislator, and I know this is an informational hearing, I think it's good that we bring these problems forward, but I will say that I think it's very, we're not doing our full due diligence here. If the folks, there's two sides to this equation. And I see a lot of folks here that have some very, very real, what I perceive as some issues that they would like to voice to us to vet out, which is good. You know, that's why we're here. However, as stated, there's no one on the other side of this issue. I don't think that we're really doing due diligence when we do this. As I look through this, I go back into my own personal history of food service. And I know what it's like to be in the middle of a lunch rush or a bar rush or a dinner rush and to have the health inspector show up. They just do. They show up when you're not ready. And it's really a stressful thing. However, this all, in my opinion, as I look at these violations and as I hear the testimony, this really, to me, because this is so one-sided at this point, this really points to a leadership issue. My question that I have, first and foremost, right out of the chute, is was there a contract signed between the state or the Department of Corrections with this vendor? Was there, somebody had to sit down and say, you're our service, so was there a contract negotiated for this service?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, yes, there is a contract between the state and this food service provider. Actually, a bit of history is that I think it was probably in the late 70s that some of our facilities started having contract food service vendors provide that service in our facilities. And over the years, that has grown to include all but three of our facilities. The St. Cloud facility, Red Wing, and Togo are state-operated food service. Does that answer your question?
It does. Mr. Chair?
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you. As I process this through, the first question that comes to my mind, and when I say leadership, I'm not throwing it in our testifier's lap. I'm throwing it into the lap of whoever, someone at the prison has to be where the buck stops at the physical facility. There has to be a line of communication. There has to be some type of dialogue between the prisons and the people they sign these contracts with for these food services. Simply put, if this is what's going on, get rid of them. How, you know, whatever happened to competition, whatever happened to saying, and I'm not going to cast any aspersions on this company because, like I said, all we're hearing is one side of the story.
This is informational, so there'll be time.
right.
To hear both
my,
sides.
My point is, you know what? Let's open this up for the competitive bid process. If there's someone out there that can do a better job, a healthier job, for less money, then we can save everyone in this room or taxpayers, and let's try that option first. I think, for lack of better words, using the nuclear option and just getting rid of all of that, the private sector, and just going straight to a state employee model, I think that's what we should save for last. I mean, at this point in the game, with our current economy and our current model that it's going, as I look at these inspection records, so I've been inspected, as Buck walks in. And I look at page one, first violation, there's one violation here starting at the bottom, no violation issue. Page three, there's 12 instances here. Of the 12, 8, no violation issue. Go to the last page, we got 6 issues here. Of the 6, 4, no violation was issued. So although I see that this is, this is a concern, if you're gonna make your case, show me violations. And don't show me your concerns. Show me the actual violations. And to use this, I think that you really need to examine your evidence here, because as we evaluate the cost of this, and the research that we have here, we're looking at putting on about 74 full-time employees. And it's going to cost the state another budgetary increase of about $2.5 million. So there's certainly a cost issue here that we're trying to deal with. At this point in the hearing, like I said, since this is a one-sided hearing, I think we need to make sure that we take this for what it is a one-sided hearing.
I respect Representative Newberg, your opinion is duly noted.
Thank you. And one final comment.
Really. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you. When you present your case, please don't. These are people. These are offenders who are doing time. They're serving their debt to society. I could care less if their cookies are burnt, and they have to eat apples. That's really not if you're going to drive home a point, because felons and sex offenders and whatnot, because their cookies are undercooked or overcooked and they have to eat apples, I don't think that's your best. If you're trying to sell me something, that's not a good way to, that's not a good approach. I have a lot more to say, but I'll just leave it at that. I think I've made my point.
You have. Thank you, Representative Newber. I just like to say that, in my opinion, the food quality and safety in the prisons do go hand in hand, and that we should not take this lightly. And it is one-sided, but we need to hear both sides, and we're hearing one side today. So I'd like to ask the Deputy Commissioner if you could just sort of talk a little bit more about that dialogue that goes on between the paid service and the department, and what happened in this case that didn't get communicated.
Thank you. First of all, just for a little bit more background, the current contract that we have for food service management goes through June 30th of 2014 with the ability to extend for up to 16 months. And at this point in time, it is our, we will be extending the contract. We're not in a position to issue a new RFP. It's our intention that we would extend that contract. The other thing that I just want to talk about is that certainly we're not opposed to converting to a state-operated process. Our agency knows that that works well in the three facilities where we have state-operated processes. However, it is an additional cost to taxpayers to do that. The other thing that I want to talk about is that operating food services in prisons is complex and very challenging. We operate these facilities, the food service, with a large number of offenders working in the kitchens helping prepare and serve the meal. So constant supervision and oversight of those offenders is important, because they are not always going to be interested in complying with all health and safety regulations, so we have to have a lot of oversight. And again, as I spoke earlier, that's really a partnership between the food service staff and the others who are in the area. Vigilance is needed for making sure that our equipment is maintained and that when there are issues like cooling or heating that require attention, that that information gets relayed quickly and appropriately to our maintenance staff and others so that we can deal with those situations and not create further problems. So as you know, the specifics of the Rush City facility inspection, I don't have that information, but Mike Locker, who is named as the person who received this report, is actually a corrections employee who is our safety manager. And so there, our state employees are very involved when there are safety inspections, health inspections that go on in these areas. So,
I think Mr. Henderson had something to say.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Representative, I just wanted to clarify. I have an answer to one of his questions and clarify another one. With the health inspection, all the MCFs from the health department get notice, and this specific inspection was given a 5-day notice, so they knew they were coming in and they did prepare for it. Okay. To clarify on the responsibility of the equipment in the kitchen, it is owned by the state and it's maintained by state workers, our refrigeration mechanics, electricians, and so on. But it's the responsibility of the food vendor to process the work orders. Okay? And the one more thing to clarify is on this is not about, this legislation is not about food and the what they're getting, a cookie or an apple or meatloaf or roast beef. But when the food is so substandard and it's barely edible, it is a safety and security risk for all of our correctional staff in these facilities. Because the day comes when you read in the paper that there was a riot in one of our correctional facilities because of bad food, and somebody was hurt or even killed, that's going to be a story. And it's something we don't want to have happen. That's why we're introducing this legislation today. I personally don't care if they're served beans, rice, and bread. But if I want them to be fed beans, rice, and bread, if that's what's on the menu.
And Mr.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we don't mean to, you know, belabor this. This is an informational hearing just so that everybody understands the issues and can correct issues or, you know, move in another direction. But I just want this committee to know that this is the fourth company in 9 years that has gone through. In speaking with the health inspector, as she said, she just found out that they weren't licensed. They took over a year ago. So it's not like if you don't like the food, you can order a pizza when you're in prison. So we need to make sure that we have addressed the issues, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I understand the issue about the licensing. That should not have happened. That should have been done as soon as they got the contract. But we have an issue in Cambridge where a state-run facility went 10 months without a license doing treatment. That was the state's fault. That was, I believe that was the Department of Health's license. That they never got their issue. So it's not just other places that happen. It happens all over, even at the state level. So we all need to work better.
I think that's it for testimony, unless there's someone else that wants to.
Any other questions from members? Anybody in the audience like to speak to the issue? Deputy Commissioner, absolutely.
So I just want to give the committee a heads up about something related to this food issue that I think is very, very important, and it speaks to Mr. Henderson's testimony about the seriousness of food quality that we serve our offenders. For over 15 years, we have been maintaining a budget of $3.29 per day per offender for food costs, and that is getting more challenging for our facilities to meet and not exceed that budget for the amount of food and the quality of food that we want to prepare and have available for our offender population. I think that it's very, very likely that next year we will be asking for an increase in this area. And as long as we're at this hearing, I wanted to just give you all that heads up because it's a real issue for us.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure that the record is clear. While we heard that correctional facility had 5 days' notice and knew they were coming up, I just want to point out that on the report it said they didn't have notice, and so I want to make sure that the record is reflects what both sides are saying.
Duly noted. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, as the Deputy Commissioner mentioned, costs are going up, food costs are going up. I see it in my kitchen and on my budget every time I go to the grocery store. It's an issue that we're going to have to deal with, but we also have a responsibility to the taxpayers to get the best we can for the least amount of dollars. And this is an issue that we're probably going to be looking at. I have one question that maybe the deputy commissioner can answer. On our contracts, is there anything in the contracts for substandard service that the contracts can be voided?
Exactly.
That's something that should be in the contracts if any new contracts come up or extended. If they're not performing up to some minimums, they want to look at getting something in there so the state has a fallback and you can start get new RFPs out if that's the choice we want to do if we continue having these issues.
Thank you. I have a question actually for either the deputy or Mr. Hendrickson about food costs and food quality at state-run facilities versus those who are contracted out. Can you sort of tell us what that looks like?
Well, Mr. Chair, you have St. Cloud, Togo, and Red Wing. They have the same menu. They get the food from the same, it's Indian Head out of Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And they prepare it in accordance with the dietary guidelines. We don't have any issues from those three facilities and with them running short and the product being non-edible and so on and so forth. I haven't gotten one incident report, information report, or email, and I don't have anything to report in a negative way, and I've been out doing site visits at all the facilities across the state, and I go into the kitchens, mm-hmm. and I ask the workers, the correctional officers, and the correctional staff, they're called line cooks and cook supervisors, and there's no issues with them. Never a perfect day. There's sometimes an offender may not like what's on the menu, but we don't care about them. But what's on the menu is on the menu and being served. Those three.
Thank you. And Deputy Commissioner, is this provider only in this facility, or are they in other facilities as well?
Mr. Chair, this contract is for all the facilities that have food service contract. And the other thing that I'd note is that the health inspections occur at all of our facilities, and you know, any given day, any of those facilities could have an issue that would cause a citation. We certainly pride ourselves in running good shops, good kitchens, clean kitchens, but these citations can happen at any of our facilities.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom, do you have any closing words?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for this hearing. I think it was very informative for members to know and understand the issue, and it's informative. So I think...
thank you for bringing this issue forward. It's something that we will obviously have to deal with in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, we can move on to the next bill. Mr. Chair, this really is... also an informational hearing about the needs of the Department of Corrections for additional employees and appropriation. Mr. Chair, it really
this information came to me based on folks going out to the facility and feeling like they needed additional staff for safety purposes. So I'm also going to turn this over to Mr. Henderson to talk about what it is that they see as the needs for safety.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House File 2401 is our staffing request addressing specific needs at certain correctional facilities. We're asking for additional 60 correctional officers throughout all 10 facilities, 6 office administrative specialists, 2 licensed practical nurses, 1 general maintenance worker, and 3 general repair workers. This request was generated from the workers at the facilities identifying specific rationale for every request while working with their local union leadership. These additional staffing requests have been brought forward at the facility level, at the local labor management meetings, and also at the statewide labor management meetings. The answer we always get from the department is, we understand the need for additional staff, but we must work with what our budget allows. Now, we've been hearing that for a number of years, and in light of the recession and the downward spiral that we've all been facing, we've worked very well with our current administration and even some of the past administration. The wardens and the local leadership at the facilities have worked very good at going down to bare bone complement, working on overtime, doing the best that they can and with the least that they got on certain days. And they've done a good job. Sometimes they take calculated risk, and to date, nobody has been injured, maimed, because of a staffing issue. We've had uprisings, these are prisons. We're going to have uprisings. But we feel as a union, we cannot continue to just keep asking. So we took it upon ourselves to identify our needs and submit the staffing request to you today for consideration. I can speak broadly on our request, and we also have 2 officers here, one from Rush Prison and one from Stillwater. Stillwater is where we're requesting the most amount of staff, where we also have, it's a very old facility, and it's gone through a lot of some reorganization and restructuring, and one of our testifiers can speak on that, and that's where we have our biggest need for correctional officers. So if there's any other questions for me, I'll stay up here along, and then we'll have the testifier come up.
That's good. Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Paul Gamel. Good afternoon, Representative Rosenthal, committee members. I'm a corrections sergeant with the Department of Corrections in our city. I've been with the department for over 9 years and have witnessed a lot of changes within our offender population. It seems as though Rush City's biggest problem is that we do more with less. And this ability to work in this manner is ideal under most business models, but jobs that have a main function of safety and security, this isn't a good, effective way to be operating, because eventually luck runs out. Our staff work hard, but we have so many obligations right now that our current staffing levels don't allow for them to be safely covered. Our security squad, for instance, is the facility emergency response team. They have 6 staff. We have just over 1,000 offenders. It's a close custody facility. So our emergency response team is of 6 staff. And throughout the day, they get tasked out to different projects and different obligations, escorting people. We can be down to 2 available responders. And we have several major incidents, group fights, staff assaults that happen, and this simply is not enough. Regularly, we have 2 security squad monitoring 1 dining room with up to 135 offenders and 10 to 15 inmate workers. If an incident breaks out while dining is happening, currently these squad members would respond to that location in the facility to assist with dealing with it, and then after it's done, they would return to their post in the kitchen, watching the offenders eat. Well, when they leave the dining room, that's essentially the security coverage for those 135 offenders that are dining there and the 10 to 15 workers. So it leaves the area unattended for a period of time. There's somebody outside in what's called our corridor area that's behind glass. They can see into the kitchen, but they can't directly intervene with anything inside the dining room because they would lack the resources then because they're allocated somewhere else. In addition to responders having to expand from our current staffing complement, we've expanded our segregation by 30 more beds, and we think that this justifies our request alone. This has resulted in an increased workload on our already understaffed segregation / security housing unit. In segregation, they have visits every morning from health services, be it a doctor or nurse, psych services, discipline, and the Office of Special Investigations. And each of these instances require a minimum of two staff to accomplish the task of escorting the offender to and from his cell, pad searching him, locking him up in chains and that. And it's a big task. And they've become so accustomed to getting by with less that their increased productivity is compromising the safety. So as one offender is being brought out of discipline where maybe he just found out that he's going to spend the next 6 months in segregation, he's being passed off to one person that has no knowledge of this. So there's a lack of security there. The safety procedures that could be in place aren't because of the staffing shortage. So, and while all of these visits are going on in segregation, staff also have to manage the incoming and outgoing offenders, in addition to scheduling opportunities for the inmates to have time for hygiene and recreation, which they only get an hour a day, but you still have to facilitate that for the entire unit. Not to mention the need for additional staff to have staff available so we can be in compliance with the federally mandated CREA laws. That's adjusting who can observe certain situations, for instance, unclothed body searches, and that we have to change our staffing in accordance with that. I know the staffing dollars seem harder to give out when we don't have a catastrophe that we're responding to, but in these instances I've provided you, there are very real need and concern.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from members? Representative Neuberger.
Just a curious word. Did the request come from the for the additional staffing, did this come from the DOC?
No.
Sergeant Kimmel.
Mr. Chair, I'll take that one.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, this specifically came from the workers from inside the units to say this is what they believe that they need to make it safer. And we put it forward. We didn't know what the supplemental budget was going to look like and if there was going to be money. We wanted to kind of indicate where the staff thought that the preference should be. Clearly, this isn't in this year's budget, but as we move forward, we think that if there's additional money, this is where they need to be placing some folks.
Representative Neuberger. Mr. Chair, thank you. One quick follow-up question. Could we hear from the DOC? How do they feel? What is their take on this?
In a minute. Any other questions from members? Thank you, Sergeant.
Thank you for your time.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mover. I think that they would tell you that if they had the staff, they would probably put some of them in some of these places. So this is about if we fund them.
Deputy Commissioner, do you want to comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While we would never turn down positions that were for our correctional facilities, you know, the work that we do in our prisons is really hard work, and we have cut and decreased staff and asked them to do more with less people, absolutely, in all areas of our facilities, and we're stretched really thin. At the same time, I believe that we run safe facilities,
You know, unexpected things absolutely can happen. Bad things can happen and will happen in our facilities. And, you know, I dread that day. But we have really well-trained, excellent staff who do the work. Our mission is about recidivism reduction and public safety. And everyone plays key roles in contributing to that mission. If we were given a bunch of money to have new positions, certainly we would look at corrections officers and our staffing. We'd also look at program staff who would provide additional treatment or educational programming that our research shows reduces recidivism. That's where we get a lot of bang for our buck. One of my concerns about this bill is that three facilities aren't listed as needing additional positions, and I believe that they're facilities that are similarly situated to the others that are, and so that, to me, I would want to do some more study before I would say these are the positions that we should have and where we should have them. The other question that I have is about the positions are listed as additional people, not additional posts. And so I'm not sure that that was the original intent of the language, but, you know, that those were some of the questions that we had.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason the facilities that are missing are not listed is we specifically asked the folks there, and they said if they were at full complement, they would.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Deputy Commissioner, one of the questions I have is, of the number, if you have a full complement of corrections officers throughout the whole system, that would be a 100% complete. Roughly how many officers are we short of that at this time because of retirements, resignations, other things? So I know the State Patrol is quite a few numbers short. They just had a school here where they're going to hire 48, and they did not even get enough people to fill the school.
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I don't know the vacancy rate at this point in time. I'm thinking it's probably 1 or 2%. We are continually hiring people. We have academies, training academies, almost every month, and so when facilities have needs, we try to find people, and sometimes that's a challenge for us, to find enough people who want to work in our facilities because it's a challenging job, and sometimes the pay for our positions isn't commensurate with what counties may be paying, so it gets tricky.
Representative Johnson.
Of that 1 or 2%, what would that actual number?
Probably 20 or 40 people total.
So if you had pretty much had your full complement, these positions, almost all these positions would be filled.
Mr. Chair,
Deputy Commissioner,
I believe that what we're talking about, though, is over and above what our complement is, and there will always be an ebb and flow with people who are coming and going.
Representative Johnson.
I understand that, how that works. Being in law enforcement, see how many people come and go, especially in the jail situation. But I do want to commend the corrections officers that the state has. I know quite a few of them. They are excellent officers. They do a great job. Unfortunately, we have a few that give them a black eye, and it's unfortunate. But overall, we have some great staff, and I want to compliment on their work.
Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, I've been trying to restrain myself, but I can't do it anymore. I'm sorry. And I want to get on the road myself, but I just wanted to ask a question of the commissioner, and I think, Deputy Commissioner, you probably heard me speak in the past. I worked at NERC early in my career as a young lad, and NERC is a medium security all-male institution, but sitting in Minnesota. And I had the opportunity to travel around the state and see through the correction system, community correction system, the prisons in St. Cloud and in Stillwater and everywhere. And I just remember walking in that prison, in those prisons, and in particularly Stillwater, and the mate slammed beside me and behind me, and even though I work in a corrections facility, scared out of my jeebies. But yesterday, I think it was yesterday, Commissioner, we heard a bill about a corrections officer. I think that was hurt significantly. That was beat, had the heck beat out of him, I will say.
That was my bill, Ms. Representative Ward.
Representative Roosevelt, and I don't remember the specifics of the bill, but I think it was in Stillwater Prison, I think, if I remember correctly. And Commissioner, having worked in a prison, a medium security institution, and watched the corrections officers there, and the work that all the staff did there, would that, I don't know the scenario behind that whole, deal. Would that have, having more people, having more availability of corrections officers, having more staff that is trained in procedure and proper help of a fellow officer, would that have helped? That's because that's going to cost the state now of Minnesota some dollars.
$17,000.
Rightfully so, and in my opinion, rightfully so. Would that have helped having more people?
Deputy Commissioner Carlson.
You can't get into that. Maybe you can't even talk about that. But okay.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ward, the staff that we're talking about was with our Office of Special Investigations. He wasn't a correctional officer, for one. And it was a terrible situation that happened to him with a long-term bad result for his health. We feel so bad about that for him. Would more staff help? Maybe. I think in prisons we deal with unpredictable and violent people, and we could have 100 more staff, and it wouldn't necessarily mean that someone wasn't going to get hurt. It's that kind of, that situation. Yeah. And it depends on the facility as well.
Yeah.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just in closing, I just want to say thank you to those that stayed to listen. These are really important issues that I think really do need to be addressed. And, we do have one more person that was hoping to speak.
Absolutely. Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Joseph Brogy. I've been working for the Department of Corrections at Minnesota Correctional Facility Stillwater for 7 years now. And I will try to make this brief, although it's not particularly one of my strong suits, so bear with me. We as corrections officers are not just a bunch of unsuspecting rubes who knuckle-dragged our way to this vocation by mere happenstance. Many of us are very educated. A lot of us came from skilled trades. A lot of us just were looking for a different line of work, especially when the market crashed, and a lot of people coming from Anderson Windows, being right across the way from Stillwater Prison, found ourselves in this job. And one thing I can say unequivocally about all my colleagues is that we care about the job we do, and we care about each other. And it's very important to us. We're not just doing this for a paycheck. We're doing this because we depend on one another for our safety and security. And if I were to leave my place of employment, it's not like leaving another job. It's like leaving people behind that I know that depended on me and depended on the skill set that I have developed working as a corrections officer. Now, to give you a little bit of background about Stillwater. Stillwater is a 100-year-old facility. I don't know if any of you have toured it, but I strongly suggest contact our warden. I'm sure she'd be more than happy to arrange it. Originally, it was built for about 1,000 guys. Right now, we're at 1,600 plus. The overcrowding epidemic, which has been endemic to correction facilities across the nation, is finally hitting home in Minnesota. That should be nothing new. Stillwater also is a very emblematic of turn-of-the-century prison architecture. It's a big monolithic building made out of glazed brick. It gets abysmally hot in the summer, which, you know, fuels the fires of all sorts of raging temperatures of inmates. At this point, if I may be concise as possible here, it's a numbers game is what we're facing. When I started, I was placed in a unit A East, and we had just under 250 offenders. Most of those worked out in the prison industry. Some were unemployed. We managed that with five, sometimes six staff. Now that same block has 285 offenders, and it's down to five staff almost all the time. And given the way our facility operates with the daily schedule, most of the time there are actually only four staff present in the block, as one staff has to be removed for various duties, dining hall coverage, that type of thing. Well, when you have over 200 of those guys out at any given time and you have four staff, you know, it's easy to do the math that the odds are not very encouraging if you're on the side of the officer. And keep in mind, corrections is one of the few jobs where your clientele and you have an entirely adversarial relationship. Whether it's law enforcement or you work in retail, you're always going to have problems with your clientele, which may be dangerous. But in corrections, there's a line of demarcation. It's almost like the 38th parallel. Corrections officers on one side, and then the inmates at all the other, and we're always butting heads. And as I always will remember when I was in the academy, the then captain came and said to us, he says, "You guys aren't going to get a lot of recognition for this because corrections is the red-headed stepchild of the justice system." And he's right. I mean, as crude as that old saying is, he's correct. For example, I'm sure a lot of you remember when Sergeant Gerald Beck was murdered in St. Paul, and I remember that very distinctly. I read about it in the paper. That was just before I started my career in corrections. Well, it was a big story, and understandably so. The police handled the investigation. They apprehended the suspect. Then there was the subsequent trial and conviction of the murderer, Harry Evans, and the next big thing took its place. Well, where did Harry Evans go? It's not like these violent offenders, these convicted criminals, just vanish into the ether. They live the remainder of their lives in a correctional facility. So when you come to a facility like Stillwater, you can see basically a catalog of all the people who were in the paper over the years and all the articles that you read about and all the things you were outraged about at the time, but something supplanted that in the public consciousness. So that's the type of people we deal with. And I believe we do a remarkable job. I work with a lot of really great people, and I have utmost faith in them that they would be there for me as I would be there for them. Again, the problem is simply the numbers game. In July 2011, it was right after the government shutdown. I'm sure those of you who are here remember that very well. It was a brutally hot summer, and I was officer in charge of A East, and we had a little altercation, and pretty soon the block decided that they weren't going to switch in and started surrounding staff, and we had a riot, near riot on our hands. And I've never seen in my career something go that close to the edge and actually be teetering on the edge without going over completely. In order to quell that situation, we had to pull staff members from every other area of the facility and lock down other parts of the facility. The problem with that, and it doesn't take a lot of foresight to see, is if we have a problem in one area, we might be able to quell that problem in one area, but all it would take is a spark in another area or a diversion in one area to let another situation going. And it's a matter of when. Not really a matter of if, it's a matter of when. This past October, we had two officers who were beaten severely in the Unit B East, and I was in B West at the time. I now work in a different unit, which is a SHU unit, security housing unit. It's used to house offenders who are transitioning between segregation and general population. One officer was had his head drummed off the flagstone, which is the floor is made of, pretty severely. He sustained a traumatic brain injury. Fortunately, he is back to work on a part-time basis now, but he still has chronic and consistent headaches. The other officer was assaulted with just a little electronic device that was a beard trimmer and a sock that was used as a weapon. He had a couple of ribs cracked, and he was out for a month and a half, and he's now back. But these are the things we deal with. We deal with one of my sergeants is missing four of her front teeth because of the place at which we work. That is simply the reality. Now, when you're talking about 285 guys and five staff, does it really make that much difference to have a sixth staff? I mean, you're still six against 285. What's the big difference between five and 285 guys or six and 285? But to us, it means a lot. It means a lot just to have an extra pair of eyes to watch where we're going. And you can never predict the offenders that we have, and you can never predict their behavior. But just the faith you have in another officer who has your back in a situation like that, you can't quantify something like that. You simply cannot. And the crux of the matter is you know, a lot of us are afraid. And it's good to have a healthy fear. But when something goes wrong, like in October, and the other blocks were all drained, and we just had a few officers walking around desperately trying to switch in the offenders we did have, we were sitting ducks at that point. And we know it. And we know that we are basically at the mercy of the divisions between or among the groups, the different groups and the divisions among the offenders, because if they were able to speak or think with one voice or any type of unity, or even a majority of them were, it would be child's play to take over a facility. And if you want to know, quite simply, the numbers that came up for Stillwater, I did those myself. I took my break times, and on my breaks I went around all the facilities and I asked all the officers and the people I know very well what we needed, and those are the numbers that I came up with.
And Mr. Chair, that's 26.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Thank you, Officer Brogy. Questions from members? I have visited Stillwater. I'm sure many of you have. If you haven't, I would suggest doing it. It is really, really a scary place to be, as are some of the other institutions, and I want to thank all the correctional officers and staff that came today. You do a really great service to the state, and we should applaud you at every chance we have. And I think these issues will be something that we will have to look into going forward. And I certainly don't consider you second-class officers. I think you're the best, and thank you for being here. Do you have any closing comments, Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think that these two issues are very serious issues that this body needs to be aware of and monitoring. Mr. Chair, when we put people in prison, we expect that we will keep the conditions we put them in livable, but we expect that we will be able to keep our staff safe. So, and nothing else, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom, and thank all of you for coming. This Public Safety Committee is now adjourned.